People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. My guest is a young musician, Leo Gefisser, a pianist, and he is the soloist with the Cape Town Philharmonic Orchestra, back in his hometown here, to perform the Piano Concerto by Ravel with the CPO on Thursday the 27th, and that's the opening concert of the five-week Spring Symphony season. Leo arrived here via a recital with the Johannesburg Music Society and will leave after a private event performing with violinist Jordan Brooks for CPO donors. And Leo graduated from the Juilliard School of Music with a B.Mus in piano performance with academic honors and is now studying for an MFA in sound arts at Columbia University. So welcome, Leo. Welcome indeed.
Thank you very much.
It sounds like you've been quite busy, because there's a whole list here. You said you've been very busy in recent months all over Europe. Is this true?
For sure. This actually came after there was a competition that I did about a year and a half ago. And some of the awards from that competition included a series of concerts around France and Italy this past summer. Summer being the Northern Hemisphere summer.
And a hot summer.
Yes, exactly. A very hot summer indeed, this past summer in France and Italy. So I did a couple of solo recitals in France and in Italy. But in the middle of these recitals, I also did a residency for about a month in this very small little village in France. That was actually the height of the heat wave, so that was quite intense. But okay. it was very lovely. But in that sense, it's been very busy traveling all over.
Just when you say a residency, just explain what that means.
Yes. So essentially, the residency part of it was that I stayed in this house that actually was once the retreat for the composer Henri Dutilleux, and essentially he would compose in this house in some days during the year. And there's also a piano in the house to rehearse on, so I did quite a lot of practicing on that piano. I also did some composing. But the residency also has ties to this conservatory that is nearby, in a nearby town. So I got to also coach some students during that residency, which was quite fruitful as well.
It sounds as though that was a bit of a highlight for you, may I say.
Yes, for sure.
You let something slip there, you said, and do some composing. Are you also a composer?
Yes, I'm also a composer. So I've been composing, you know, some. It's primarily been electronic music, but I sometimes incorporate some acoustic sounds as well. But yeah, during that time, I was mostly just composing on paper, which was very nice.
The other thing I saw on the stuff I've been reading about you is this business of your interest in sound, actual sound.
Oh, yes.
Which it sounds as though you're tying up that with your composing, if you say using electronic effects and so on.
Yes.
What is the fascination with sound?
Sound, I mean, it's such a all-encompassing term that it's almost difficult just to start from one point and talk about it. But I think in terms of my own interest in sound, I've been working a lot with spatial sound, but spatial is probably the incorrect term, because all sound is spatial, actually, but multi-channel, in terms of you have a array or a setup of speakers in a certain space, in a certain configuration, and composing for that space. So that kind of, and that's like slowly shifting in terms of my thinking, in terms of acoustics and in terms of specifically architectural acoustics. So I've been kind of thinking along those modes for sure. But in terms of, again, in terms of sound, I've also been interested in the field recording aspect of it. So sometimes, you know, during my free time, I'd go into the field, whether it be, you know, it could be like Camps Bay or it could be Sea Point or whatever, taking a microphone with me and capturing some sounds and using it in some way in the composition. So, yeah, among other things.
I was going to say, yes. Yeah. So, for example, you mentioned Sea Point and Camps Bay and all that.
Oh, yes.
Are you also doing this in South Africa? You are putting together stuff to be used in a future composition, for example.
Yes, exactly. Actually, I think it was about a year ago, or just over a year ago, I took a lot of my recording equipment that I have in New York currently in the United States, you know, on the 16-hour flight to Cape Town, and just, you know, recorded some sounds just because.
On the plane?
Took my recording equipment on me on the plane, and then recorded some sounds in Cape Town.
Oh, right. I see what you mean.
Yes.
You mean.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, all of this, I'm sort of quite intrigued by what you're saying, because I'm not sure I entirely understand.
Of course.
When you say spatial and all that with speakers, eight speakers, whatever, and put it in a space, how yes. big could that or would that space be?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. I think it just, it depends on the composition.
I see.
So you could, if the sound or the composition is somewhat intimate or small in scale, obviously the space would be somewhat small in scale. This is just as an example.
Yes.
But if it's quite expansive, then obviously there's the quantity of speakers or the quantity of sound sources can be expanded as well. So it really shifts according
to composition. That does make sense. Yeah. That makes sense. But how do you listen to that? How does a member of the public, a music lover or someone who admires you, how do you perform that, or how would I listen to it?
Right. So this is like a I could talk about this for hours, but there's this technique in audio engineering where called binaural rendering, which is essentially you have a set of sound sources in a multi-channel configuration in many different places, but binaural rendering is essentially compressing or shifting that whole configuration into something that can be listened to in 2 ears by binaural. So essentially, I've been actually experimenting with a setup that I'm currently building right now in software, where you have a multi-channel configuration and you can be followed around in the space, and whatever you listen to, you can render it into stereo or binaural. And, you know, it would be quite difficult for somebody to resource like 10 speakers and just listen to the thing by itself, right? So
you're putting your hands over your ears like that. What would happen if you were wearing headphones, if a listener was wanting to wear headphones?
Yes, that's where the binaural rendering would shine, because that's meant to be listened to in headphones. But yeah, it'd be very difficult to say, oh, maybe I want to listen to this 12-speaker composition. Let's get 12 speakers from the nearby store.
Yes,
listen
exactly.
to it. That's almost impossible.
Matched and all that sort of thing for sound.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Goodness me. Okay. Well, let's do something a little bit normal now.
Of course.
Leo. And your first piece of music is one of the lyric pieces by Grieg.
Yes.
Now, I'd just like to know why you chose this, as beautiful as they are.
So it goes way back to when I just started learning the piano, which was when I was around 5 or 6. And around a year after that, obviously I was still kind of figuring stuff out on the keyboard. But my parents handed me this book, paperback book of Grieg lyric pieces. And it was, I think, one of, if not the first paperback sheet music that I read from, that we got in our home. And I just started flipping through these pages, and I just started sight reading these pieces, and I just completely got lost in them, so much so that I think I must have gone through the entire set of lyric pieces,
because there are a lot of them, aren't there?
There's a lot of them. Yeah, he Grieg composed throughout his life these lyric pieces. This lyric piece, it's Opus 47, number 2, happened to be one of my favorites. I think it was simply the melody and the gesture of how it's written that really impacted me. And also the evocative title, which is Album Leaf, because it evoked many things in terms of the, you know, the Norwegian landscape and such. So this was quite meaningful to me, and I think this was one of the Grieg pieces that I returned to, I think, the most in terms of the whole set of the lyric pieces. So this one's somewhat special to me.
one of Grieg's lyric pieces, Opus 47, number 2, with that nickname, that title, Albumblätter, is it? Album?
Yes, precisely, yeah, album leaf. I could not pronounce it properly in Norwegian, so I'll just say the English.
But it's interesting in view of what you've been saying about sounds and the world of sound and recording things on Camps Bay Beach, that you chose that one with a title like that. Shows that when you were that young, you were already thinking about sound and the world of sound.
Of course.
Even as a young man.
Yeah, I think sound, and specifically environment and space, certainly has had a lasting impression on me throughout my life since I was young. You know, I think in terms of what Cape Town has to offer, I think the quality of the light in Cape Town is not something that you find anywhere else, especially, you know, regarding also, I've had also a long-lasting interest in hiking. So I've always had this interest in exploring spaces. So perhaps that also ties into the fact that the exploring side of creation is something I'm interested in.
Because I also read somewhere that Plettenberg Bay had quite an effect on you when you first visited there and sort of lit up the idea of hiking.
Yes, for sure. My late grandmother had a house in Plettenberg Bay, and we used to go there every once in a while on every holiday when I was living here in Cape Town. And of course, as most of you would know, Plettenberg Bay, there's this peninsula called Rubberg Peninsula. That is this long stretch of land and of rock that you can literally just walk around. It's about 9 kilometers. And I think there's something spiritual about this place that's quite hard to place. Something that quite, you know, that's had a long lasting impact on the way I experience life, and what I want in life, especially. Because, you know, it's one thing being, you know, confined in a room, composing or practicing, you know, doing what you do. And then there's another thing of actually experiencing space and experiencing lights, you know, that there's an equilibrium there that I always try and strive for, that I learned through my experiences of hiking in South Africa, specifically in Rubberg and specifically in Cape Town as well.
Interesting you talk about light here in Cape Town or South Africa.
Yeah.
Do the same sort of things affect you internationally?
Well, that's a really good question. I'd say, at least maybe I could speak in the moment of performing the piano, for example. A lot of the time, you know, you sit on the piano stool and you start performing, and you know, you take a couple of deep breaths and you get into the music. But I think it's always a sign of being immersed in the music if you yourself are immersed in your thoughts as you perform. So a lot of the time I'm not actually thinking of, here I am in this space, in this actual space that I'm performing, but I'm also thinking, okay, what does the composition actually evoke, or what is the space that the composition creates, essentially?
Okay. Yeah. Would you think that while you were performing as well in front of an audience, or just while you were practicing?
Right. Yes. I think it's usually a bit of both.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah,
fair enough.
Yeah. I think it probably is even more so when I'm practicing, because, you know, it's just me in
the
room.
Yes, exactly.
So I have, you know, so much freedom just to think and get lost in my own thoughts. So, but it obviously takes a while to get used to that mode of experiencing when there's 300, 400 people around you in the same room.
The pressures on you are slightly more, shall we say, important because of those people.
Exactly, for sure, yeah.
But I also want to find out, Leo, what caused you to start learning the piano? Well, I think you were quite young, weren't you?
Yes,
I think you said 4.
Yes, it was around, yeah, I think I was around 5 or 6, but actually the first instrument that I learned, as one does in pre-preparatory school in Cape Town, is the recorder.
Oh, yes, of course. Oh, so you started on the recorder.
I started on the recorder, and actually I had my parents purchased a recorder for me, I think, when I was around 4. So I had the recorder even before I went to school to do the recorder. But actually, at the same school that I went to, there was an upright piano sitting somewhere, and I just stumbled across it, and I was just curious, so I just started playing on it, and I said to my parents, can I learn this? They were like, sure.
Good for your parents.
Yeah, exactly. So, in that sense, obviously, I started quite young, but it was also somewhat of an ordinary introduction to things.
Okay.
Yeah, just the natural curiosity for things,
when
I guess.
You stumbled across, as you say, this piano and sort of tried it out, what did you, I mean, obviously, you couldn't play the piano or read music, so was it just a sense of making it sound, fiddling around with the keys, trying to get some sort of idea?
It was exactly. It was just completely just experimentation, trying to see what does this key do if I play it this way? What if I put my hand on the other side of the keyboard, or vice versa? It was just experimentation, and then obviously I had to learn the fundamentals, as one does.
Because when you got this paperback book of Grieg's lyric pieces that you said, obviously at that stage you could already read music.
Right. So that paperback book, obviously, that came a year or two after I started learning the fundamentals. Okay. But I think I learned a lot about the fundamentals even just looking at the Grieg, not even just the fundamental books, but also just experimenting with the score in and of itself.
Even though you were so young and didn't know how to play the piano properly, you were still able to read the music sufficiently to get you interested.
For sure, yeah. I also, there was also, we had a CD player in our house, and we had CDs of recordings that we could listen to in terms of, you know, certain artists that us as a family liked. So listening to those and comparing between how I listened to the recording that was captured versus how am I actually playing on the piano was something that was a significant learning experience for me.
Were your parents musical? Do you come from a musical family?
Well, my mother was a dancer. So she was actually a professional dancer earlier on in her life. And my brother plays the jazz trombone. So he's in a band. But other than that, it's funny, actually, my family calls it a slipped gene.
Yes, because for you.
Right. So because it's you know, my great grandmother was a concert pianist.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that was that.
Okay.
And then now I'm performing on the piano in terms of performance. So it's almost like the gene just like almost slipped down after three generations. So that was
you.
Yeah.
I'm sure
somehow
you're not unhappy about that.
I don't know. Yeah.
Now look, what is this next piece coming up, Leo? Radiohead. I certainly have heard of this. A rock group, I think.
Yes. So in terms of,
is it going to terrify our listeners?
This one, I hope not.
Okay.
I hope not. I sincerely hope not. But funny how this kind of, you know, this connected to the fact that my parents consistently purchased sheet music for me to just flip through after I got the Grieg book. And one of these was a set of tab books for certain pop music bands. Like I got some Coldplay books, I got some Pink Floyd books, and then I got a book on Radiohead's In Rainbows album. And I started flipping through and seeing what these sound like. And then I listened to the Radiohead recordings themselves. And, you know, I had my iPod at the time, started walking around listening to music. And again, I just got completely lost in the way that this music was constructed. There was something quite significant in terms of the link in which these people in the band, in Radiohead, the majority of them are classically trained. So a lot of the compositional sentiments in them have a lot to do with arrangements and have a lot to do with actual, you know, writing on paper composition. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what I ended up finding out more into my research on Radiohead. But at the time, that was the impression that I got listening to it, which was quite incredible listening to this album for the first time. And this song, Reckoner, specifically stood out because it has this kind of complex rhythm subliminal complex rhythm on the underside of the composition, but it's incredibly lyrical at the same time. So I thought that combination was quite effective.
I'm not afraid to die.
that's the group Radiohead and a song called Reckoner. And I don't think anyone's fled the radio, Leo. Leo Gifisa is my guest on People of Note this week. Leo's going to be playing, he's the soloist this week with the Cape Town Philharmonic in Ravel's Piano Concerto. We'll come to that in a moment. But what I was saying to you while we were listening to that music is, when I first saw your name, I mispronounced it in the Afrikaans way, Gifisa. But you call yourself Gifisa. Is that a normal way to pronounce it?
Right. It's funny because it's such an unusual, like you don't hear the surname so often.
No, you don't.
So it's funny because in, I think anyone who pronounces it, I'm like, that pronunciation works. Okay. It's okay. You can pronounce it that way. I don't even know how to pronounce my name. So, but I'd say the etymology behind the name is primarily a Lithuanian name.
Really?
So it's not an Afrikaans name, even though obviously the
yes.
at the beginning is very much like, you know, Afrikaans past tense. Specifically, yeah, Lithuanian, a little bit of Irish, a little bit of Greek as well in terms of the ancestry. So it's mm-hmm. a whole combination of things. It's not just one name. Yes, and actually it was, yeah, I think I can probably go down a rabbit hole on this name for quite some time, but I can leave it at that.
Okay, but are your parents South African? Were they born here?
Yes. My parents are South African. My mom is primarily from Cape Town, and my dad is primarily from Joburg. And actually, they met in Joburg. They were working for the same company. And now we're based in Cape... Oh, my parents are based in Cape Town, I should correct myself. Now I'm currently based in New York City. And it's funny, as we speak, my parents are currently moving into their new home, which, so it's been quite a lot
here
moving
in Cape
around
Town.
In Cape Town, yes.
Oh
yes.
My. So you're not coming to an old home, you're coming to a new
home. New
home,
yes, exactly.
And how's New York for a young man like you?
Oh, New York is incredibly busy. And stimulating, and intense. Basically, everything packed into one city. So, in that sense, it's been a lot, but it's also been an incredible learning experience for me.
How did you land up in New York?
It was a long, long path up until New York. So, first, I could say that. Maybe just to start from the beginning, I was born in London, in London, UK, and I stayed there for the first 5 years of my life. And then my immediate family and I moved to Cape Town, and I stayed in Cape Town for about 10 years. And I still consider Cape Town to be, you know, I'm as a spiritual being, I am South African. So.
Okay. And Cape Town is your home.
Yes, exactly. So... and then I lived in Cape Town for 10 years. And then eventually I made the decision myself that I had to study somewhere overseas for my musical studies. And my father also got a job in the States where we can move anywhere east of Chicago. So we ended up intersecting with Cleveland, Ohio, which was, when we moved, it was quite the culture shock, as you could probably imagine.
I can absolutely imagine.
Oh my goodness. It was like, you know, people driving on different sides of the road.
Yes.
People speaking in different kinds of slang
Twins.
That we're not, not quite used to. But it wasn't a worthwhile adjustment. And we lived in Cleveland for about 3 years. I went to the Cleveland Institute of Music for my studies. For 3 years. And then after that, I started my studies at Juilliard. And then I moved. My first year at Juilliard, it was interesting because my first year happened right slap bang in the middle of the COVID pandemic.
Oh, goodness.
Which was unusual in many ways, especially for a first year university experience, because everyone essentially was, you know, stationed in their dorms. Nobody could really be in the same room as the other person, and we were taking classes over Zoom, so it was very unusual. But during my first year at Juilliard, in New York, My parents were still staying in Ohio. And then after my first year in Juilliard, my parents and my brother moved to the UK because my brother decided to finish his high school studies just outside London. And I was obviously still in New York by myself studying for the remainder of the 3 years. And that's how I kind of got to New York. So it's been kind of like, you know, one place after the next, still finding our way.
Why did your parents come back to Cape Town just as a matter of interest?
Well, most of my family is stationed in South Africa. So that was the main link. And also, obviously, I could say it was because of a change of scenery, but that would be somewhat self-contradictory because we were changing sceneries all the time.
Sounds like it. Yeah, it sounds like it.
But I think, again, to harken back to the quality of life here and the light especially, that's also, I think, what my family really, really desired, I think, for life. Mm-hmm. Especially because, you know, I was in college during, I mean, I'm still in college, but I'm studying abroad. My brother is studying in Edinburgh, so he's also studying abroad. So, you know, now my parents had the freedom to decide what kind of life they want to live, you know, with their children out of the nest, so to say.
So to speak.
So they chose Cape Town. And, of course, my and specifically speaking, most of my family is in Cape Town. So that was definitely the link as well.
What about the light in New York, for example, as opposed to you've been speaking very interestingly and positively about the light here in Cape Town?
Of course. I'm still figuring that out.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I think, you know, in terms of living in New York, you know, as one could potentially imagine, you know, you're in these incredibly small apartments for a lot of the time. So it's really, it's about bringing it onto yourself to seek out those kinds of environments. And especially because life in New York gets so incredibly intense all the time, that I'm still trying to figure out an equilibrium between, you know, doing what I do and seeking out those experiences that I've so loved my entire life. You know, so it's been quite a struggle in that way. But you know, stepping stones.
Well, exactly, stepping stones.
Yeah,
baby steps, as they sometimes say.
Exactly. Yeah.
When you were in Cleveland, for example, did you go and see the orchestra?
Yes,
the magnificent orchestra there.
Yes, I mean, one of, if not in my view, the better orchestras in the States, you know, over generations, and it has such a rich history as well. When we were living in Cleveland, we went to, it must have been around 9 or 10 concerts of the orchestra. And I think the one thing about this orchestra, and I think certainly the CPO has this quality as well, where the sound is so together. I mean, you can't really hear individual people playing in an orchestra. You just hear this one body of sound that moves with the music. You don't really hear that in orchestras anywhere else, obviously, apart from the CPO, of course. I mean, it's CPO specifically is such a special orchestra. But also, you know, the Cleveland Orchestra has this quality as well, which was incredible to hear, especially in the hall in which they performed as well, which has amazing acoustics.
The Severance is called the Severance Hall.
Yeah.
Leo, we need another piece of music now. I see we're in for Vangelis and Blade Runner Blues. What are you giving us this time?
Yes. Another work of music that is perhaps not fully classical, but actually, Vangelis composed this electronic work in a decidedly classical fashion. I can give some background behind this in terms of my connection with this piece, Blade Runner Blues. So I've always had a lifelong interest in film, And especially starting when I was around 9 or 10, you know, we used to go to the DVD shop and rent out some movies from the DVD shop and watch them on weekends. And my parents gave me this copy of Blade Runner, the film Blade Runner by Ridley Scott. And it was one of the first films that I saw where all elements of the film, whether it be sound, whether it be the cinematography, whether it be the architecture that was represented in the film, just all was a complete immersive experience in a multitude of ways. You know, especially the world building and the architecture that was in it. And Vangelis, I think when he was composing the soundtrack, completely captured this as well in the sound. So in this piece, Blade Runner Blues, I think the main character is experiencing this kind of existential crisis in the movie, and he's walking around the cityscape, completely lost in his thoughts, as to, you know, in the experience as well in the context of the movie. And this piece, it's almost like if you can transcribe this piece for orchestra, you'd hear the saxophone, you'd hear the strings, you'd hear the piano, but all of this in the score is completely electronic, all synthesizers, which kind of reminds me, I saw this photo, it's quite a famous photo of Vangelis, where he's sitting in his studio with like, must have been like 50 synthesizers all surrounding him, and he's like, which synthesizer do I use for this context? But he truly picked incredibly well for this piece. So I'm excited to share this piece with you guys.
I wonder if you saw the film Blade Runner. That's called Blade Runner Blues, the music of Vangelis, and a choice beautifully introduced, thank you, by my guest, Leo Gefisser, who, as you heard, that film affected him so hugely. What we haven't spoken about, Leo, and we're nearing the end of our session, is the concert this week. You're playing the Ravel Piano Concerto, which is an interesting one, isn't it? Because it's got that curious start with a slapping stick, and then the most beautiful slow movement. But I gather this concerto is quite important for you.
For sure. Actually, this was the very first concerto, or I should say the movement of a concerto, that I performed with the Cape Philharmonic Orchestra. It was for the Len van Zyl Conductors Competition, I believe, in 2016. And of course, when I learned the very first impression that I had of this piece was the score itself, the edition, which was like no other edition that I've ever read from before, just in terms of the type fonts. Just wanted to mention that. But I think in terms of the fusion of styles that's present in this music, you know, there's obviously the form or the structure in and of itself is quite classical. But there's some jazz in it.
Yes.
There's, you know, the orchestration. Ravel's orchestration is always just pristine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, performing it with the orchestra in comparison to just playing it on the piano is a vastly different experience in many ways. So that was essentially a huge learning experience, especially performing that movement for the first time with the CPO. But I think the special part of this piece, the Ravel Concerto, is that now I have this incredible opportunity that I'm super grateful for, performing the whole concerto with the CPO at the end of this month. And you know, when I learned the first movements initially, of course I learned it to eventually perform it. But then I was also, in the same way that I was flipping through those pages of the Greek lyric pieces, I was also sight reading the second and third movements and just seeing what does it sound like exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, you know, getting that opportunity to perform the remainder of the piece is something that I'm very grateful for.
And is Ravel's writing for the piano easy?
It's
challenging,
it's,
I'm sure.
One could say, I guess people could say, or people usually say, that it is "quote unquote" pianistic.
Oh, right. Okay.
In a way that, obviously, there's some challenging moments, but it's not challenging in a way that it was inconvenient for the pianist. It's challenging in a way that is completely, you know, expresses what is meant in the music, but also, you know, almost written from a pianist's point of view, which is
good
very,
for
very,
you.
Yeah, very good for pianists in general, I'd say.
Just before we say goodbye, Leo, and see you on Thursday, what else are you doing? How long are you going to be in South Africa?
Well, in terms of my busyness this Northern Hemisphere summer,
yes.
It is going to continue to be busy. So after this CPO concert, I'll have the incredible opportunity to perform with a colleague of mine, Jordan Brooks. And we actually go, we're performing on the same stage actually at one in a youth competition in South Africa, I believe when I was around 11 or 12, at the Samra Hubert van der Spay competition. And he was incredible in that competition. I've always had an incredible impression of his performing and his playing. So we hadn't performed together since. So to have the opportunity to perform together is fantastic. He's also studying abroad as well. He's studying in London. Straight after that concert, I go straight to New York and I start my next semester at Columbia. It just starts straight away. So it's nonstop in that sense. But I think just being in South Africa is a breath of fresh air, I'd
say.
So
nice to hear you say that. Yeah. How old are you at the moment, if you don't mind me asking?
23.
Oh, okay. Yes. A young man indeed. So you'll have all the energy you'll need to go back to New York and plunge back into your life.
Ooh, I hope so.
Now, you've got to tell us about this last piece of music, Leo, that you've... I nearly said inflicted on us, but that will be unkind. I don't mean that. That you're going to share with us.
Sure. Yes, this piece is unusual for a number of reasons. Firstly, the composer Eliane Radig. Well, I should introduce the piece first. This is Occam Delta. And this French composer, Eliane Radig, actually passed away quite recently, just about a couple months ago. And she was a pioneering electronic composer who composed almost in this drone style of composing, so to say. But she was particularly interested in intonation when she was composing. And when I first listened to Eliane Radig's music, it was the electronic works that I listened to initially. And the way in which she shifted the synthesizer sound over time so that I could hear the intonation within the sound and all the interacting tones within the sound has given an incredible impression on me, and intonation is something that I'm currently experimenting with in some of my compositions in certain ways. This piece is also unusual in the fact that later in Eliane Radig's life, she shifted her focus away from electronic music into acoustic music. And what she said about the shift was that this was the sound that she'd always been searching for throughout her life. And this was when she was around 70 or 80 years old, late in her life.
Yeah.
And she did a series of pieces called Occam, and then after the word Occam would be a name for like a body of water, say like an ocean or a river or a stream or something along those lines. And these would all be acoustic pieces for any kind of instrumentation, completely open, not scored. Eliane Radig would give the scoring and the compositional directions orally, which was very interesting. But these pieces call for the instrumentalists to listen in real time to the intonation with their other instruments. So it's almost like you're hearing or you're listening to this music listening to itself, which I think is an incredible concept in terms of the listening experience. And yes, this piece is incredibly atmospheric, possibly overwhelmingly so on a first listen, especially when I first listened to it. But it's also just about letting the music listen to itself and then having it wash over you in that respect. So,
Leo, thank you for that introduction. And we're going to have to leave it there because we've run out of time. But we get to see you on Thursday the 27th with the Ravel Concerto.
Yes.
Leo Gefisser, my guest. And best of luck, Leo. And come and visit us again sometime.
Thank you.
For another chat.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.